This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio's Reporter Roundtable Thursday, and let's check in first with Meredith Colias-Pete, who covers education stories for the Post-Tribune. Meredith, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, the big story I know that you have been working on from the school city of Hammond school board meeting the other night, they've let the other shoe drop, at least one of the other shoes drop here. They kind of made threats and mentioned to some people and had to talk with people in extensive public meetings about the possibility of closing schools, cutting staff members in the city of Hammond and the school district, and we understand that's going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, so things are kind of finalized for now. On Tuesday, Hammond had their school board meeting. The board voted to close three schools, Columbia Elementary, Lafayette Elementary, and then Miller Pre-K and Hessville. So that'll be done at the end of the school year. And then they're also looking to cut up to 150 staff. It appears that they're looking at like a $10 million deficit next year, and that could grow to up to maybe like $25 million over the next couple of years. So they're saying that they really need to do this.
Yeah. Now, this initial plans for cuts and the closing of the three schools, how much does Superintendent Scott Miller figure they're going to be able to save with this first move?
Columbia and Lafayette are kind of off of North Calumet on the city's north side. Mm-hmm. I believe it's over $1 million to run all three of those schools.
Yeah.
But part of their decision that they're saying is that these are older buildings. You know, there's been a lot of talk of, you know, Miller Pre-K has a lot of building issues. Apparently they went in and they're estimating that these three buildings need almost $3 million in repairs.
Wow. Now, I understand that this is the building that basically supplies classrooms for the special education and related type programs, right? It's not a regular official everyday elementary school there, is it?
Right. The Miller facility, it has pre-K, Head Start, and special education as well.
I understand, and you've had in your story as well, too, in the Post-Tribune, that the school city of Hammond used to take in students from outside of Hammond, and then they stopped doing that, and now they're considering that they may have to do it again to help you keep the enrollment stabilized, because I know that's, of course, a big concern. There's been enrollment drops, seems like, every place in Northwest Indiana, and the school districts deals with the financial impacts of that. So is it, I guess, the possibility that school city of Hammond may look to students and parents in other cities to bring kids in?
Yeah, absolutely it is. You know, part of the plan is that they need to bring in more students. The deal was back in the 2017 referendum when they asked voters for a tax mm-hmm. hike to build the new Hammond High School, but also get a separate referendum for their budget. The deal was that they made to voters is that, oh, we'll close enrollment and have this only for Hammond students. Well, the problem with that being is that their enrollment dropped since then. It's not entirely due to that policy, but they've lost almost like 550 kids this year. And so when you calculate that the state pays like $6,800 per kid, I mean, that's quite a big budget hole that they're looking to fill. In the past, historically, most of their students have come from probably Gary and East Chicago.
Right. Yeah, the two coast cities where parents would not mind having kids bussed over or taking them over to school, I guess, if there's a close school, I guess, within Hammond, I guess, to wherever they happen to live, to be sure. So is there any deadline that they wanted to set for that to decide whether they want to be able to allow non-Hammond students to attend?
My understanding is that they want to do this. It's supposed to come up in a meeting in June in a couple weeks.
Okay. One of the other things I know that came out in your story as well, too, talking about not only the closing of the three schools in Hammond, but also, too, having to cut back on staff. There was, a rather ambitious number they threw out, during the discussions of 150 jobs. Where do things seem to stand right now about that?
They haven't released publicly yet at this point. I think that they're crunching numbers and looking to see how many people are going to retire and things like that.
Yeah.
The total, I guess, of staff cuts is they're hoping to save about $7 million or so. They're looking at, you know, where their students are and where they're losing students. And they're saying that, for example, the 550 or so number that I brought up earlier, like 370 of those kids that have left the district have been at the elementary schools. So they're looking at if they don't lose people through retirement and attrition and stuff like that, that the cuts probably would fall proportionally there.
Now, obviously, the school board didn't have a unanimous vote on that decision to make. I guess from your story, it says it was 4-1. Who is the dissenter, and what did he or she have to say?
The dissenting vote was Trustee Carlotta Blake-King. She's pretty new to the board. It was elected, I think, last year. I think that a lot of the objections that she's brought up is that, you know, these schools are on the city's north side. Some of these schools are a little more impoverished. That sort of when you're looking at budget cuts, that the weight is falling on, you know, schools on the north side that are serving more minority students, was her argument.
Now, we've talked about what the school board members had to say, and one in particular. What do the parents that had to attend the meeting to find out the bad news, what did they have to say about that?
You know, obviously, obviously they're upset. Mm-hmm. Especially that they're saying that, you know, 2 years ago they voted for, you know, their property taxes to go up, and now 2 years later their kid's school is closing. You know, both with Lafayette and Columbia, the couple parents that I spoke to really characterized it as a very tight-knit, you know, these are very close communities. You know, one of them who said, you know, she knows every teacher in the school, for example. Lafayette in particular is a turnaround school, has done very well academically, you know, since about 2010 or so. The state has given the school A's or B's, and so they're really a big success story for Hammond. And obviously there's that and just the uncertainty of, you know, busing your kid away from a neighborhood school.
Cool. I know in your story you mentioned in more detail where the youngsters that are in the affected schools are going to be going. Will you briefly kind of run down the list and tell us who's going where, so to speak, when the schools do have to close?
Yeah, absolutely. So the moves are kind of this. The kids that go to Miller Preschool are going to be moved to Morton Elementary. The special education students are going to be split between Edison and O'Bannon. Mm-hmm. And for Columbia, they're going to move to Irving Elementary. And then Lafayette, most of the kids, it looks like, are going to go to Maywood Elementary. There's a few, like 40 or so, that are going to Irving. And then it looks like Hammond is going to move like 30 kids that already go to Maywood, they're going to go over to Lew Wallace now.
Okay. We're talking with Meredith Colias-Peep with the Post Tribune about some education stories. And one other one, too. Now, here we are into the summer months, or might as well be pretty soon. And we talk about sub-zero temperatures here. And one of the stories that you had out there is dealing with how the school districts can write off these snow days and cold days. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that this came up. The State Department of Education kind of put out a memo back in February where it's allowing schools, both high schools and school districts that have gotten an A grade from them. Basically, they're allowed to bank up, if that makes sense, like extra instructional time.
Yeah.
And so when you go along and you have a certain amount of time, they're letting the schools that qualify use that time to basically cancel out bad weather days. Of course, back in like late January, you know, we had that stretch of really cold weather where schools were closed for basically a week. And now you're having, you know, schools like Munster, for example, has pretty much already made up the days that they lost, because three out of those 4 days, they were basically able to write off.
I see. Yeah, it looks like, according to the list that you have in your story, that virtually every public school district in Northwest Indiana is eligible to be able to take advantage of this. I guess just the charter schools, which are not part of the public school system, are exempt from that, isn't it?
You know what, and thanks for asking that. I'm not entirely sure, but the schools that are eligible had to have had an A grade this past year. That's why they're eligible.
Okay,
right?
So there's this criteria that the state makes you set that you have to be able to be. It's maybe kind of a reward for being a good academic steward, I suppose, in your community, that you get to take advantage of these go-backs or whatever, you know, if you have to make up for it, to be sure. So, well, also, too, one of the stories that you had out there to take a look at is another interesting story, in this case from the Lake Central School Corporation, and it's about Special Olympics. Tell us about the Unified Game Day.
Yeah, absolutely. This is just a really fun track and field day that Lake Central puts on. Their director of special education helps organize this. Like I said, it's a field day, and it's much, when they say unified field day, basically they had kids from four different schools, and you have kids with special needs, kids with not special, you know, without special needs, actually. They kind of just compete in track and field and stuff like that. So it was a really, really fun day for them. So the event is put on by the National Special Education Organization, and of course that made the news, I think back in March when Betsy DeVos went before Congress and defended the Trump administration, saying that they wanted to cut all federal funding from Special Olympics. Of course, parents and, you know, advocates were really up in arms about this. And it had been the third year that they had suggested this, and Congress really is just not going to let that happen. But anyway, this event at Lake Central is funded by the Special Olympics, so we really wanted to kind of show folks what it was all about. The kids, like I said, ran track and field, long jump. There was, like, face painting and bubbles and temporary tattoos and stuff like that. So they, you know, got to play with their friends and had mm-hmm. a really fun time. Becky Grimala, who runs special education over at Lake Central, is just really, like, the whole point of this is to make sure that the kids with special needs are really integrated, to just make sure that, they're kind of it really just encourages all the kids to play together, basically.
I understand some of the parents of the youngsters that participated in the Special Olympics got something out of it, too. They got to enjoy a lot of this, I'm sure, and probably a lot of activities that they got to see maybe perhaps for the first time.
There was fun to speak with. There was a lot of parents, in the audience kind of coming and watching. And, the things that they, we had a really good conversation. The things that they really felt like was important for this kind of activity is, especially like those I talked to, that their kids were on the autism spectrum, for example. And, it's kind of just, their kids' nature to have just a really set routine, to know what's happening and kind of not go out of their comfort zone. And, they love these kinds of events because it was really fun for the kids. It got them out. It really encouraged them to socialize and get them out of their comfort zone, basically. And so the moms were really about, events like this and, that they said are pretty really good for their kids.
Well, Meredith, thanks for spending time to talk about the stories that you had covered, put in print and online as well in the Post Tribune. And we also should mention, too, that I know that you're also gathering the information together. We mentioned earlier about the school city of Hammond and the plans to close three schools, cut some staff members. I know that the same, at least as far as staff members concerns, happening in the Griffith Community Schools. And I know that you're working on that story. So that'll be coming out in the paper and in print as well as online, too. We'll look for that as well. Meredith, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
Meredith Colias-Pete is education reporter for the Post Tribune. Continuing on with Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Dan Carton. He covers state government, state house news for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and he's checking in with us from Indianapolis. And Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, I know that first we have a story that you put out, which is kind of giving us an update on the leadership team that works with Governor Eric Holcomb at the State House, and it has a local flavor to it. Tell us about the person who is taking over in a very key financial role at the State House.
Yeah, Chris Johnston, who he's a Crown Point native. He's going to become the new Director of Office of Management and Budget. It's sort of a state agency that oversees all of the state financial agencies, from the Indiana Finance Authority to the Department of Revenue to the Distress Unit Appeals Board that oversees Gary Schools. Mm-hmm. Chris Johnston has been the governor's deputy chief of staff for the past year and had worked in the Mitch Daniels administration. He's coming in because Micah Vincent, who currently holds the job, is taking a job in the private sector at the end of June. And you see this from time to time where after a budget year, every couple of years, the people who put it all together for the governor's office tend to take off for greener pastures, either because it's a ton of work and the private sector is probably more profitable. But so Chris Johnston, he's an experienced guy. He's coming in from Crown Point, and I'm happy to report that his mother found out about his promotion from my story.
Oh, really? Well, how nice.
I ran into Chris the other day.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he said his mother yelled at him for not calling and telling him about it.
You didn't call your mother. You used to be ashamed. You didn't call your mother. That's interesting. and it's interesting to note here, too, and you mentioned here about the turnover. It's not mm-hmm. unexpected. And we know, besides a lot of work that goes into putting together all the effort for a two-year state budget for the legislature to review and then to enact and then for the governor to sign into law, with all that paperwork that you have to do, I'm sure that you pick up, if you don't have the experience to begin with, you pick up a lot of experience along the way. And I wouldn't be, and probably nobody seems to be, and you probably aren't at all surprised that Micah Vincent might have been courted by some people that he knew in Indianapolis. Maybe he goes out for drinks or something at the end of a long day at the State House. They get together for dinner and drinks, and they talk about business, and that's how these things come up. And so he finds out about these opportunities that will crop up from time to time, as what happened with Micah and taking this job in the private sector.
Yeah, and it happens a lot. It's working in the governor's office is all-consuming. I've seen these people, working 16-hour days, 20-hour days, especially towards the end of session.
Yeah.
And remember, they're working year-round, too. So, the legislature's in session for 3-4 months. Governor's office has to actually run everything in state government year-round. So, I don't know specifically about Micah, but there is, kind of burnout in this position where you it's a huge responsibility to prepare a $36 billion budget that affects 6.6 million people.
Yeah, that's true. And you mentioned, too, in the comments that you got in the prepared statement from the governor about this when he appointed Chris Johnston to the job, that Chris has a specific responsibilities or within the OMB that he's taking over, but he has a certain specialty, I guess, because he's from Northwest Indiana. He's very much aware of some of these big projects that are going to be coming up here in the next couple, 3 years.
Right, and you're speaking about the South Shore project. That's mm-hmm. that's a big component of the governor's agenda. They just put in a bunch of extra funding for it in the state budget in case the federal grant isn't as large as they originally expected. So they put some $200 million in the state budget to make sure that the projects can move forward, even if the federal funding is less than they hoped. And Chris has experience on the finance side of things. And a lot of this is going to be run through the Indiana Finance Authority, which is a separate agency of state government, but indirectly reports to the OMB directors. So, he's in a good position to oversee these projects and make sure they, at least on the money side, come to fruition.
And I suppose even though he's probably not kept up to date on all of the things involving the Indiana Distressed Unit Appeals Board, it won't take him long to get up to speed and learning about the situation with the Gary Community School Corporation. If he doesn't know personally in talking with people up here in the region on time to time, it won't take him long to do the homework to be able to be ready for the next meeting that comes up here, so he's aware of these things.
Right, and he's the OMB director, is the chairman of the board. The DUEB has an executive director who actually does sort of the day-to-day operations. Mm-hmm. So the OMB director is just making sure that everything that's happening sort of is in line with the governor's agenda, the state's interest to make sure, especially in terms of the loans that the Gary School Corporation has, that there's a path toward getting the district back on firm financial footing and eventually repaying the $40, $50 million of loans that they've gotten to continue operating in the face of changes in the school funding formula, massive reduction in enrollment, which, as everybody knows, in Indiana, the money follows the child. So if a kid leaves a school, and I heard you talking about this earlier in regards to Hammond, kid leaves the school, that money is gone the next year.
That's right. That's right.
You have no choice but to make cuts. If you don't make those cuts, you end up like what they had in Gary, where they were, they had a district that was over capacity in terms of teachers and buildings and resources, and the state had to come in and make some pretty steep cuts.
That's right. It takes a certain takes a certain special experience and knowledge to be able to help operate these organizations like the DOAB to be able to be supervising what happens there. So he has to be aware of a lot of things too. One of the other stories that you had in the paper here not long ago, and you'll have to do a little backstory for us here for folks that don't remember about this. It involves the Lake County Council. It's a ruling that came down from the state's highest court, but it involves some Lake County judges. Give us a little background here about what the judges were seeking, and now what the Lake County Council is going to have to do.
Yeah. So in 2017, there were 14 Lake County judges who filed basically an order with the a court order ordering the Lake County Council to increase the pay for court employees because they hadn't gotten a pay raise in many years, due in large part to limited financial resources at the county. A lot of people in the county employees weren't getting pay raises, but the judges were saying that they were having a hard time keeping court staff because people weren't getting paid or they weren't getting raises. So the judges, using their powers in the judicial branch, put forth an order directing the Lake County Council to immediately increase the pay for these employees. The council responded, challenged that in court, and eventually they came to a settlement in 2018 where the court employees got a 3% raise, and then I believe subsequent raises in future years. But what the Supreme Court decided was whether or not the county had to pay the judge's attorney's fees. This was a question. The county claimed that the judges had done some excessive billing for the attorney's fees, or the judge's attorneys had done some excessive billing. The Supreme Court disagreed, and they upheld. There was a special judge who set the fees that the county would have to pay. Because in a case like this, part of the settlement agreement was the county would have to pay the attorney's fees. So now they were fighting over the attorney's fees.
Yeah.
And so the council is on the hook for $176,000 to pay these attorney's fees on behalf of these judges. And, you know, to some extent, all the court employees who benefited from the order for pay raises.
Now, you mentioned that in the story here, in going back and, in dealing with this, the pay raises and all that had to be dealt out by the county council at the order of the Supreme Court on this for the judges, basically, giving their people the opportunity to get their pay raises out of this, too. How did the taxpayers here in Lake County manage to help pay for everything? They had to do some juggling of the budget, to be sure, didn't they?
They did, and it actually worked out pretty well for the county council on the pay raises, because the state court system has been slowly taking over all of the document processing in every county, moving them onto a statewide case management system called Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, Lake County had to pay for its own system. The state is putting all 92 counties on this system and paying the cost, sort of indirectly. It's the people who use the court system pay the cost. They get charged a document fee. But that money, that's basically how the county was able to move some money around. So the money that they're no longer spending on this case management system that was specific to Lake County, they can put towards these pay raises for court employees, because the state is taking over the cost of maintaining and upgrading the case management system.
We're talking about Dan Carton, who's a State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the stories that he's recently had out there in print and online. And I'll also ask you, too, for some assessment here, looking at this past legislative session. But one of the stories that you focus in on is definitely local. It's talking about what the governor's finally signed into law, that House Enrolled Act 1015. Explain, if you will, briefly what 1015 is all about, and about the reactions come about here, because it's not only going to mean some opportunities for economic development, I guess, in the city of Gary, but it's also going to make some big changes for everybody around the state, won't it?
Yeah, this is a massive change to Indiana's gaming landscape. It's something that a lot of people have thought for a long time. Other people have tried to prevent it for a long time, and it finally went through. The biggest thing probably for the region is it allows the two Majestic Star casinos to move from Lake Michigan to a single location in Gary. The law doesn't specify, but the company that owns it, Spectacle Entertainment, has said that they're looking at an unspecified site adjacent to the Borman Expressway. And this will be, their plan is to have a $300 million casino and a 200-room hotel at this site with entertainment. So the city is hoping to that will attract further development in that area beyond just your typical interstate exit stuff. And then the city is also hoping to redevelop the Buffington Harbor site that the casino will be moving out of. They have a plan to turn it into a intermodal transit facility where instead of freight trains going all the way to downtown Chicago where they get stuck behind other freight trains because there's so much freight traffic, they would be able to transfer some of their goods at Gary, possibly warehouse it, move it back out, move it out faster. And the city is going to take the lead on that. There was initially a plan for the state to get involved in that, but it didn't make it across the finish line at the state house. So you've got the casino move, Buffington Harbor redevelopment. And then another major thing is the legalization of sports wagering.
Yeah.
And starting September 1st, or that's when it could start. It's up to the Gaming Commission to finalize the rules and all that. But September 1st, you'll be able to place wagers on sporting events in Indiana casinos and on mobile devices. So you'll be able to sit at your house on your phone and, you know, place a bet on the Cubs game. And depending on how far the Gaming Commission wants to take it, legislators left a lot up to them. You could bet, you know, pitch by pitch if you wanted to. At a baseball game, you say, oh, I think the next pitch is going to be a strike. I'm going to put $50 on that. You just type that into your phone, and you might win, you might lose. And it's a big change for Indiana where, you know, we only have these limited number of casinos, and you had to go to a casino previously to engage in pretty much any gambling except for some online horse racing, but this is going to change a lot of things because you'll be able to, you know, use your mobile device to place a bet on sporting events anytime you want, anywhere that you want to bet on Korean badminton at 2 a.m. You'll be able to do it. So.
I know that this is a pretty big bill. I mean, not only in scope and the impact, but certainly, I guess, in size, too, because I know in your earlier stories that while the session was still going on, when the governor finally got this bill, that he had an awful lot to look through. He didn't rush to sign it off into law. He wanted to review it very, very closely, I guess, element by element. So it's not surprising that he would take his time and want to be sure that he did the right thing.
Yeah, and he did take the full amount of time. The governor gets a week after receiving the bills from the General Assembly to decide whether to sign it or to let it become law without a signature or veto it. And he did take a full week. I think this might have been the only bill this year that he took the whole time on. And it was a big bill. So I've talked about the Gary stuff and the sports wagering, but there's the potential for a new casino in Terre Haute. There's the potential for live table games dealers at the two racinos in central Indiana. There's a bunch of hold harmless language that seeks to ensure that, for example, with the Gary Casino, that Hammond and East Chicago won't see their tax revenue go down. So it shifts some of that revenue from the new Gary Casino, if it's extremely profitable, back into Hammond and East Chicago under certain circumstances. And, you know, it changes some of the tax rates on all the casinos in the state. So there was a lot of stuff in this bill, and Governor Holcomb made it very clear that he wanted to read every word and make sure that he understood what legislators had done because, you know, as you well know, towards the end of session, a lot of things end up in legislation that nobody really knows where they came from, and they just sort of get put in there at the last minute, and not everybody reads every word before they vote on it, and the governor wanted to make sure he knew what he was getting in for.
Now, on that note, Dan, here, I'm going to ask for just a little, a couple minutes or so we have left to talk today, your assessment of how the session went because of all these major items that came up besides the two-year state budget that had to be presented and reviewed and debated over and finally enacted into law.
Yeah, it was... a surprisingly, a lot of accomplishments this session, I would say. you know, besides the gaming bill, they did pass a budget that increases school funding fairly significantly. So, as we talked about, it's the money that follows the child. So, districts that have more students will see more money coming in. Districts that are losing students will lose less money because there's an overall bump, but they're still going to lose money if they're losing kids. But then, you know, you see a lot of other stuff. The South Shore Line funding, the $200 million there, that kind of came in at the end to make sure those projects would get done. The bias crimes legislation, people forget about that because it got done early in the session. But, you know, Indiana was one of five states for a long time that never had a bias crime law. Now it does. Some people claim it doesn't go far enough. But given the partisanship of this General Assembly, I think you probably weren't going to get much more than what you got out of it. There was the Hammond Data Center legislation that provides tax breaks to develop the former state line generating plant into a large data center for companies to store their data and create technology jobs around the region. There was a big project in terms of the Kankakee River that flooded last year and in previous years, and the General Assembly passed a law that changes the commission that oversees flood prevention projects and put in place an ongoing funding source, much like they have for the Little Calumet River, to make sure that this commission can do a lot of flood control projects along the Kankakee and prevent future flooding problems. You saw the school bus safety legislation. It's been a big push after those three kids in Fulton County got hit by a driver when they were boarding their school bus. Legislators upped the penalties for illegally passing school buses. They reformed the Porter County election system after the last year's election, called it a fiasco, that took 3 days to get any results out of Porter County because of how the election was conducted. So they put in place kind of a more professional team over there that are going to handle elections on an ongoing basis rather than just leaving it up to the county clerk to focus on at election time. And Griffith got an extra year to complete its move out of Calumet Township. They were facing a deadline this year in November to complete that, and they've been kind of rebuffed by the other townships that they're looking to join. So they'll have at least another year to try and work that out, or another legislative session where you could see something like Griffith become its own township or something like that. So a lot of stuff got done. And
that's
not even
sure.
to mention getting rid of the state superintendent of public instruction.
That
was
that almost disappeared into the woodwork, yeah. Didn't it? In the crush of all the other stories and other topics that came up. Well, Dan, thank you very much for the great impromptu presentation there, the review of all of the important things involving Northwest Indiana that did come out from the General Assembly this last session, besides the changes in the gaming system in Indiana and the changes for the casinos and the like. And as always, we really thank you for spending time with us to go over these things today.
No problem. Anytime.
Dan Carton is the veteran statehouse reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on with, let's check in with Greg Tejeda. He covers news in the city of Gary for the Post Tribune, and as always, Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, one of the stories you had is a pretty major story. We've talked to many times about situations at the Gary City Hall. They've had to do some shifting around in the years past, moving people to other space in downtown Gary to work out of. And now I guess there's a plan to bring everybody back into the fold, it would seem here. Tell us about the plans for a City Hall remodeling project and where the money to do all that work is going to come from.
Well, it's because of the fact they actually want to sell off what is officially known as the City Hall Annex,
mm-hmm.
building at 839 Broadway that actually once upon a time, was a Sears Roebuck in downtown Gary. They want to sell that building off. They want to get rid of the property. They want it off the books, which also means all those people working out of there still need to work somewhere. So the plan is you bring them back to City Hall, and things would be a little cramped currently, so they want to do a little bit of remodeling. Now, as it turns out, there had been a project sort of in the works they were trying to put aside some money for. The idea of to build a facility for parking municipal vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And they, as it turns out, they had about $1 million in the city budget that was put aside for just a little over $1 million that was put aside for that explicit purpose. That project is kind of on hold. You know, it's, you know, they didn't have enough to do it now, and they've decided the money could be better used now being put into City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also some problems, you know, with regards to the roof at City Hall. It leaks. I mean, it's the reason why they haven't had a proper City Council meeting at City Hall in about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, they've been over at the Genesis Center, haven't they? Over one of the meeting rooms over there, right?
Well, actually, the last couple meetings have been at the that facility in downtown, the Art House.
Oh, okay. Oh, they're at the Art House itself. Okay, I know that they have met. They have had City Council meetings over at the at Genesis Center, but I didn't know lately if
they were meeting. But the last two have been at the Art House, and we've been told they're going to stay at the Art House until they finally, sometime this summer, go back to City Hall. Oh. Although they're not willing to specify the date.
Okay. Did anybody on Common Council, when this all came up for discussion at the recent meeting, seem to be terribly concerned about the price tag? We're talking, you know, about $1 million in the fund, but I guess they figure it would take that much to be able to do the work to get these people in some good office space and move them back in?
They have to put them somewhere, and, yeah. You know, these projects cost money.
One of the other stories that came out of the council meeting as well, too, and you had highlighted in your story in print and online here, was talking about some funds that have been transferred around in the community development department that is actually going to benefit getting some repairs made to senior housing in the community. Tell us a little more about that.
Trying to do a little bit of upgrade on some of the existing buildings, make sure they remain livable. They had a couple $100,000. Actually, it was money that was already in one account.
Yeah.
Within the city budget, is being moved over to another account within the city budget. But it was kind of either way, it was for the same purpose. So it's just a matter of who gets to spend it, who's actually going to wind up taking credit for being able to come up with some additional housing.
One of the stories that you had as well in print and online in paper recently involving the Gary Common Council talked about, I guess, a discussion that was brought up here that the council had to work into, I guess, deal with an issue that was really before the city's housing authority. It was about a special use permit for a businessman in Gary. Tell us a little more about what this businessman wanted to do and how the Common Council got involved in that.
Well, as it turns out, this businessman now owns the storefront at 642 Broadway, which was the old Jackson's store, you know, right in the heart of downtown. The old signs are still up, but it's been sitting vacant. He's managed to buy it. He has this idea he'd like to turn it into a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually got this idea for an ethnic-themed restaurant and club where events could be held. He sees a place where you could have multicultural events. It could bring something interesting, and it'll be right there in the heart of downtown Gary. The problem with that is that the Gary Housing Authority actually owns most of a three-block stretch of the 500, 600, and 700 blocks of Broadway.
So I guess it's having
and
to...
And somehow this particular site managed to get past them. They didn't get ownership of that. They were hoping to be able to use eminent domain to be able to take over the property. And then this guy came in and was able to buy it. So now they're having to deal with him. And they've got their own ideas how they'd like to put all this land together and possibly in another 2 or 3 years be ready, start seeing if they could try to attract a developer who could build some sort of major project in the area. You know, they talk about this thing, the possibility to revitalize downtown Gary, bring retail back, bring in something resembling the old days, what used to be
right
in Gary. However, you have this... businessman with his plan for a restaurant right in the middle, literally right in the middle of their three-block stretch of land that they have.
Well, tell us
what he was before the council was that he was seeking a variance. His current property is zoned in a way that he can't have a liquor license there. He would need the council to specifically issue him the permit that would allow him to have a liquor license and allow him to open for business. And that was the way the Gary Housing Authority came in and urged the council to totally reject this. They don't want this. They want this guy preferably to go away.
Mm-hmm. And what turned out to be for the council? What was their decision?
The council wound up siding with the Housing Authority. They refused to grant the special use permit, which means He still owns the property. He still has his plans to go ahead with a restaurant. He's just not going to have that liquor license, which he admits is probably going to hurt the potential profitability to operate a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And this matter is currently in the court. In fact, there's going to be a hearing coming up mid-June is the next hearing, although it's not expected to be settled by then, in terms of who actually is going to, like I said, the Housing Authority is trying to use eminent domain to take over the property, which means this businessman may wind up having his property bought out from under him.
Yeah.
And bottom line, the court's ultimately going to decide this, and the council actually didn't want it, was kind of reluctant to even get involved in this, but ultimately when they were pushed into it, they took a vote and sided with the Housing Authority.
Yeah.
And you now have a businessman who is official, who says, his official line is, that's fine. If they want to buy him out, you know, he'll take their money.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he'll even find another site for his restaurant.
Yeah.
But,
well,
and by the way, that was the official stance of the mayor of Gary. She would have hoped that maybe he would try to find a different location. They'd be willing to help him do that.
Well,
so we'll see if we're getting an ethnic restaurant of sorts in Gary anytime soon.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happened after what the council did in supporting the Housing Authority on this, too. And I know, Greg, one of the other stories that you had out there, too, in the Post Tribune that you can take a look at and check out in more detail, also came, I guess, the official action came from the Common Council. But it's another story that was even before the council was a question that the council was bringing up about changing the minimum age for hiring firefighters in the city of Gary to the 18. Tell us a little about that, a little backstory about that, please.
Currently, you have to be 21 years old in order to apply for employment with the fire department. The council president, Ron Brewer, wants to bring that down to 18. He believes that, you know, currently they have people, the fire department has people going into the high schools, sort of trying to recruit, get people interested in possibly wanting to work there. But then the problem is they graduate at age 18, and they can't apply for a few years. So they feel like they're losing any potential. You know, the people who might have interest. They figure if they lower the age down to 18, you can get people literally, you graduate, you can apply. In fact, it actually used to be this way.
Yeah.
The current fire chief, Mr. Bradley, made the point of saying that he was 18 years old when he applied. Some 20-plus years later, it worked out good for him.
Yeah, you mentioned in your story the fact that Chief Bradley had just finished his studies at Lew Wallace High School when it was still open, and got his chance to become a firefighter that way, too. So he was 18 when he did that, so it's not unusual to...
Well, as he points out, and other city officials pointed out, you can go into the military at 18, you can serve your country, but you can't work for your city.
That's how ironic, I suppose. It's some reason that should make some changes here. So that we.
And also, as the chief pointed out, there's actually a year-long process of training you have to go through before you actually formally get hired.
Mm-hmm.
So even if somebody applies at 18, we're talking probably more like 19 or just barely turned 20 before they actually get the job, or actually start working. It's not like we're going to have three teenagers out there trying to put out our fires in Gary.
Yeah. Don't they, as part of the training too, from what you know, they have opportunities for learning more about firefighting by taking advantage of this MAC training center over in Valparaiso?
Yes.
Well, it sounds like this is going to be a great idea to not only get more young and up-and-coming firefighters into the ranks at the Gary Fire Department, too, but make some moves to get other communities if they are not hiring younger employees to do so, too. So appreciate finding more about that. And as always, Greg, thank you for joining us on the program today, and we'll look forward to more stories coming out to you from the city of Gary. We hope to have you back soon.
Thank you.
Greg Tejeda covers news from the city of Gary for the Post Tribune. Preparing for the birth of a child can be one of the most blissful times in the life of a family, but sadly for thousands of expectant mothers every year, infant loss can turn that bliss into tragedy with very little warning. Statistics show that 1 in 4 women experience pregnancy or infant loss. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dodson recently spoke with Amelia Kowalson of Emma's Footprints about the work that the organization is doing these days to help lost families, as they're known in the region, heal.
When President Ronald Reagan announced the existence of Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month in 1988, he said in a speech, "When a child loses his parent, they are called an orphan. When a spouse loses her or his partner, they are called a widow or widower. When a parent loses their child, there isn't a word to describe them. Sadly, infant loss is a pain that many parents in the region understand, but one that society too often minimizes or ignores. Amelia Kowalison founded Emma's Footprints following the loss of her daughter, Emma Rose, in 2014. Amelia, can you take a few moments to share with us your journey to start Emma's Footprints?
Well, our journey started in 2014, after our twins, Alex and Emma, were born prematurely at 31 weeks. They were immediately taken to the NICU at Porter Regional Hospital, and at about a week old, we found out that Emma had had a severe stroke in utero. So we had her transferred to Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis, and Alex actually was not able to go there, so he had to remain at Porter while he finished up his care. What happened is that while we were at Riley Children's Hospital, we received numerous care packages from people all over, and it was so kind and so touching. My husband and I literally cried every time. We were just so blessed by what these people did. And so when Emma passed away at 23 days old, in lieu of flowers at her funeral, we asked people to bring care package items so that we could do this one-time act of kindness to provide that love to families at Porter. Well, what happened is that one-time act of kindness just grew and grew and grew, and all of a sudden we had basically a house full of donations and items, and the funeral home had been full of donations and items. So we reached out to a local attorney, we set up a fund, and we established our organization, Emma's Footprints, with another organization out here underneath them. And over the past for almost 5 years, our organization has grown so much. Our community has been so loving and graceful to us that we are now our own established 501c3 as of a few months ago, which is very, very exciting. We are now providing care packages, NICU care packages, to all of the NICUs in our area, as well as Riley Children's Hospital and Beacon Health in South Bend. We have helped Lurie Children's Hospital. We provide our bereavement bears, which are bears that when family goes through a miscarriage or infant loss, they can take home with them so they're not leaving empty-handed. We have bereavement care packages on our website, www.emmasfootprints.org, that people can order and have sent to people. We also have a new product that we just launched, which is our rainbow baby care packages for families that are pregnant again after loss. And then we also have we have four support groups in our area, two in Porter County and two in Lake County for NICU families. We are working on workshops, which we've done in the past and we want to bring back. We have our Mother's Day event, which we actually just had this past weekend. We were able to pamper and love on about 130 women who have experienced pregnancy, infant loss, or having a child in the NICU. There were masseuse, hairstylist, makeup artist. We had amazing speakers. We had a photo booth going. There was a photographer taking flower crown photos, which people are going to be sharing with us, and we will be putting in a book along with their story about finding hope after loss or the trauma of having a child in the NICU. And we just continue to do whatever we can to support and help families in our community and beyond.
For families experiencing pregnancy or infant loss, having the time to say goodbye can be a very important step as they try to make sense out of what has happened. How has your organization helped during this time? Now, I understand you have counselors on your team.
Well, the counselors that we have, we're not actually counselors, so I want to just clarify that. It's peer support that we provide. So we have families, mothers that have experienced this as well, that will walk with you through your journey. The person that we do have right now as our bereavement care team leader is Michelle, and she runs another company called Juno's Promise, which is a doula organization that helps families through stillbirth and through the pregnancy and birth of a rainbow baby. We are hoping, once we have an office in the near future, to have an actual therapist on staff. And that's one of our big goals to have. But another way that we support families is that every hospital in our area has something called a cuddle cot for when a family experiences a child born still. And what that cuddle cot does is that it keeps the baby's temperature at what it needs to be so that the family can have more time with them, so that family can come in and meet the child so they can take pictures, so they can bathe the child and have those moments that studies have shown really prove to help the family through their journey. We provided those about 3 years ago. Another thing that we have for our NICU families is that we have the peer-led support groups. So we have these two wonderful ladies, Brittany and Taryn. Brittany is our NICU care team leader, and she runs our Lake County ones, one at St. Anthony's in Crown Point, and then another one at a pizzeria in Crown Point, and then at, Carriage Pizza in Crown Point. And then Taryn runs one at Porter Hospital and then at a Starbucks here in Valpo. And so those have been really helpful for our families in the NICU or who have had a child in the NICU. And then we also provide a ton of online support. We have a pregnancy after loss group. We have a NICU support group. We have a bereavement group. We provide articles and resources. And we just do whatever we can to help families in their time of need, just as we would want to be helped. We're here, you know, we're here 24/7. There's always one of us that can be here, and it can be at the hospital if a family needs us, which we do. We've helped plan funerals. We go in and we have pictures taken of the children. We will provide meals. We will do anything that we can to help families when they need us.
What would you tell those who have suffered a loss but don't know where to turn?
You know, I have that question a lot, and I always say just walk with that family. Be there. Dig your toes in deep and let them know that you're there. Don't walk away. Support them. Remember that child. Let them talk. Let them grieve how they need to. Don't put a timeline on them. I think bringing a meal is always wonderful. Talking about their child. Don't be afraid to say their child's name, because they're never going to forget their child. They're never going to forget that they had that child. That child is always a part of them. It makes my heart so happy whenever someone says Emma's name. So I would say just continue to let their child live through you, and just honor that family by honoring their child and honoring their feelings, and always, always offer grace, because once you lose a child, you are a different person. There's so much of you that has changed, and it's a different journey in life that you're now going through. So that grace is so, so important.
And finally, Amelia, how can lost parents and their families get in contact with Emma's Footprints?
Well, they can find us on Facebook at Emma K's Footprints, or they can find us at Instagram at Emma's Footprints IN. They can reach out to us at info@emmasfootprints.org, or they can call us at 219-299-9246.
Amelia Kowalison is the founder of Emma's Footprints. Emma's Footprints is an organization with a goal to sustain lost parents and their families through the fog of grief and care for them in every stage of healing and hope after loss.
And thanks, Dee, for that report. And our thanks as well to Dan Carton of the Times of Northwest Indiana and to Meredith Colias-Pete and Greg Tejeda from the Post Tribune for the stories that they've contributed on Regionally Speaking's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We're off for Memorial Day. We'll be back on Tuesday.